Thank you, Mr. McGee. Good afternoon, brethren. I'm glad some of us are awake. I'm not sure where the rest of you are. But indeed, what a beautiful day it is. We had the opportunity today to spend a little bit of time in the yard and see some of the first flowers opening up. It's nice to see those investments of dirty fingernails coming into something beautiful. So it started January 2003. And when it started, the original three-character designation actually had a middle character of the letter E, not a usual number like had been traditionally used. But later on, it was adopted to a number 8. And finally, it was given the number 787. And after a contest, was given the official name of Dreamliner. And sometime in the first quarter of 2011, the first deliveries of Boeing 787 Dreamliner is supposed to take place. It's had a number of delays where the aircraft has not been ready because it was an ambitious change to their usual structure. A lot of suppliers from around the globe, from many countries, from civil and government-related companies, but also the structure itself uses a composite material, not a usual aluminum frame. There were a lot of changes to what they were putting into this aircraft, so there have been delays. However, with the scheduled deliveries, companies that have purchased some want to get using it right away. And as a result, there's had to be training for ground crew, for maintenance crew, for cabin crew, and also the cockpit crew as well. Now, the maintenance crew is able to train on an aircraft that doesn't yet exist in a virtual reality type environment. They're able to do a virtual walk around the aircraft using their mouse or a pointing device, and get access to the maintenance hatches and see what tools are required for various parts. The cabin crew has a chance to familiarize himself with the cabin and find out where the various hatches are, where storage compartments might be. And the cabin crew also, rather the cockpit crew, they find out where the instrument panel is. And they actually have a stepped training leading, culminating in use in a pod, kind of like the pods we see at amusement parks, where they climb in, and it's pneumatic-powered, goes up and down, and has all of the controls that they would see in the final aircraft. Now, even though the aircraft doesn't exist, they won't be touching the aircraft for a while longer. They're being fully trained in it because their models are so representative of the final product. It took a while for regulators to check off on, yes, we approve you using these models, but when they saw that the representations were, in fact, accurate to what was coming, they did give their approval. Now, models aren't something that we're unfamiliar with. We understand them. And we understand virtualization of technologies or implementations. Modern Christendom likes to argue that Moses is the antithesis of Jesus Christ. After all, he brought the law. He brought the law, right? Is he, in fact, the antithesis? Well, if we turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, in verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food." Verse 4, "And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." In this very passage, we see Moses and Jesus talked about in a similar context. It's been our tradition in the Church of God to talk about Moses as being a type or modeling Christ. So in the split today, the first split, I'd like to talk about how Moses teaches us about Christ, in particular, how Moses' prayers teach us about Jesus. How Moses' prayers teach us about Jesus. This becomes more important to us in the Church of God as we take this time before spring feast days to get to know Christ better, to see him more clearly and try to actively, in a more concentrated manner, seek to reflect him in our lives. We'll be starting in the book of Numbers. We'll be spending a lot of time in Numbers. So if you would turn there, please. Numbers chapter 10 is where we will start. The book of Numbers talks about the children of Israel wandering through the wilderness, roughly divided, the first generation and the second generation, as they traveled through the wilderness for 40 years. Numbers chapter 10, verse 35. So it was, whenever the ark set out, that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." Moses had a pre-flight checklist before the ark set out. This wasn't a mere formality. This was something that would have been uttered to the hearing of the children of Israel as an expression of their dependency on God. Who was their leader? God was the leader. The Lord was their leader. And unless God cleared the way for them, they would have little chance of surviving. Never mind the wilderness, but also the people that were against them at that time. We can lead with our own strengths, and we can do okay for a while. However, when we do not have God leading us, or directing us, supporting us, correcting us, we will invariably, spectacularly fail. All one has to do is to take a look at the tabloids, at the newsstands, to find examples of such flameouts, right? Well, that would be us without God leading us. John 15, verse 5. In John 15, verse 5, Christ said, "I am the vine, you are the branches, and he who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing." We are dependent on God. Moses gave us that example. It reminds us of, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Now that you're in the book of John, I'll turn you back to Numbers. Numbers 10, this time the next verse, 10:36. Numbers 10:36. "Return, O Lord." Verse 36, "Whenever it came to rest, he said, 'Return, O Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel.'" Return, O Lord. The people then would have safety when the Lord returned and rested with them. Is this perhaps looking forward to a resettling of the promised land? "Return, O Lord, return us to the land you promised our forefathers." Could it also be referring to the leadership of the Messiah, his authority, when all people would return to him, the tribe of Judah in particular, who would reject him first? This appears to be part of Moses' post-flight checklist, if I can use that analogy again, in the people's hearing. In both of these instances, we see a dependence on God, and he's not afraid to admit it. The second lesson. The second lesson, he has a prayer with compassion. With compassion. I don't know about you, but I like campfires. I like relaxing by campfires. Not too close, not too far back, enough to enjoy the atmosphere. And it's amazing how the type of wood can impact the fire. Pine makes it exciting. It can also make it hazardous, depending on how dry the ground is. There are different kinds of wood. Elm has a number of varieties where you can put that on the fire and it makes a hissing noise. It's almost lulling. I like putting in some juniper or cedar that grow around these parts because the smell of the sap that burns is so distinctive. I do like that aroma. Campfires can be very enjoyable, and how welcoming it is, especially in the winter, to come into a home that has a nice roaring fire in the hearth. I don't know about you, but I tend to like to back up to them and heat parts of me that generally get cold. How nice that is in the winter especially. However, forest fires, on the other hand, are not so enjoyable. Fires in general, we can see fires in the news in Japan right now. As a result of the earthquakes. There have been fires last year in Australia devastating many, many acres. Actually, in Australia, it would have been many, many hectares, wouldn't it? Yellowstone is often victim of fires. California, how often is California in the news with forest fires? Where people have to flee their homes, see them destroyed, lose all they have And they're the lucky ones who escape, right? Fires have a nasty side as well. Numbers 11. Numbers 11, starting in verse 1. Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. So what happened? So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. Moses didn't say, it serves you right. You guys are complaining. God can hear. He hears our prayers. If they're effective prayers, if they're prayers of complaining, he hears. So it serves you right. But no, he prayed to the Lord and the fire was quenched. Why is it in verse 2? Then the people repented. They cried out to Moses. They asked him for help. Why didn't they go directly to God and repent before him? I don't have an answer, at least not for today's message, but they called to Moses. In some of the forest fires, we see on the news of firefighters who are on the ground will make a fire break. That's where they clear out what has yet to be burned and make a spot, a swath, in front of the fire where there is no fuel. That way the fire can burn up to that point and stop and not proceed on. Well, this was no regular fire. It is, after all, the wilderness. What's combustible in the desert? Have you come across burnable sand? Ignitable rocks? This is the fire of the Lord. You cannot make a physical fire break in this instance. And Moses did the only thing that could possibly work. He prayed for the people. He had compassion and prayed for them anyways. How many gospel accounts are there where we can read that Christ was moved with compassion? I don't have a count here. That may be some homework that we can each look up between now and Passover. How many times do we see Christ moved with compassion? And what does he do? What is his response? How does he treat the people? Were the Israelites or the people in the New Testament that moved Jesus such, are they really that different than we are? Were they greater sinners than we are? And how compassionate should we be for each other as well? So the second prayer that we looked at shows Moses praying with compassion. Number 3. The third one, with candor. With candor. We'll pick up again in chapter 11 of Numbers, verse 4 starts out. The rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember how much better it was in Egypt. But it starts with what? If the rabble, other translations say riffraff. Discontent can spread. I like talking about my backyard. When we first moved in, we planted a peach tree. Some of you can remember me mentioning that before. And you might be tired of me talking about that peach tree. But it's so instructive, I'll bring it up again. I saw pictures of it the other day when it was first planted, and it was about the height of the lectern. Just a little thing. This past summer, it grew up so some of the branches were up as high as the eaves of the roof. And we don't have a hobbit house. It's a normal-sized house, so it's grown quite tall. I had to prune it back again this spring, and it has produced some nice fruit for us. However, last summer, in the early summer, I purchased an apple tree. No, that was two summers ago. I purchased an apple tree. Tiny little apple tree. And as it grew, it seemed to develop an infection of some sort of fly. And as a result of that infection from the fly, it got some blight on the apple. And I noticed the next summer, my peaches, as they were starting to form, started to shrivel, discolor, dry up, and fall off. And I thought, well, that's not too bad. It's just affecting this one tree. But then I noticed my plum tree having the same thing happen to it. And shortly thereafter, my other peach tree. had the same problem. And I did some research on it and traced it back to the flies that came with my apple tree. And whatever the problem was, whatever the blight, it traveled from my apple tree to my peach tree, to my other plum tree, until it finally affected all of the trees. It's funny how discontent can be like that, isn't it? Discontent can spread so easily. And that's what happened in this particular case. However, we see that from Galatians 5:9, we'll reference that, turn there later, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. Discontent is like that. It is a sin. Let's pick up the narrative in verse 10, Numbers 11, verse 10. Moses heard the people of every family wailing at the entrance to their tent, and the Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, "Why have you brought this trouble on your servant?" It amazes me how Moses talks with God, with the Lord. I imagine myself in his position and shaking. But that's not how he starts, is it? "Why have you brought this on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as if as a nurse carries an infant to the promised land, to the land you promised on oath to their forefathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing, 'Give us meat to eat!' I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you are going to treat me, put me to death right now, if I have found favor in your eyes, and do not let me face my own ruin." What a remarkable relationship he had with the Lord, with the one who would become Jesus Christ, to be able to speak so freely, openly, respectfully. Could anyone just speak like this to God? Or does it require a special relationship? In the Garden of Gethsemane, we see in Mark's account, Jesus said, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch," he said to his disciples. In verse 36, he says, "Abba, Father." And when you look at what the commentaries say about this particular note, "Abba, Father," there is a close connection. This is a discussion that roots itself from intimacy. This is not just a general relationship. This is not his first prayer. This is indicative of a deep relationship, one where the one praying can express candor, can be open and honest, respectfully, with God, as Moses was. But it requires a foundation. Can any of us imagine walking up to the President of the United States saying, "Hey, Pop, I have the keys to the limo. I'd like to take Air Force One for a spin. Do you mind?" We might say that to our own father, and he'd say, "I don't have a limo or an aircraft." We might say that about the family jalopy, and he would consider and either award the keys or pick up a broom and say, "Sure, clean up your room first." Or if your room was like mine, maybe he'd hand a rake to you. This comes first. We ask some things of our physical fathers because of the relationship we have. And when we have a strong relationship, a relationship built on trust, one that has been built, we can ask different things. We can speak a different way. We speak to our close friends in a different manner than we might speak with our further circle of friends or acquaintances, don't we? Well, Moses here shows us a reflection of Jesus to come, of a close relationship to God, one that accompanies with candor. Lesson number four. Lesson number four, or prayer number four that we'll look at, here he prays for his opposers. For his opposers. Let's turn to Numbers 12. Numbers 12. We'll start in verse 1. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses?" they asked. "Hasn't he also spoken through us?" And God didn't hear a thing. No, it says, "And the Lord heard this." Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. And at once the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out to the tent of meeting, all three of you." I can't imagine they would have been terribly relaxed when they heard him speak to them. This must have been like hearing a parent use our middle name. "Paul Andrew Wozlikoff, come here." That was never followed by anything good. "Come out here, you three." So it's interesting, when we start verse 1, we see the reason was because of his Cushite wife. And yet further on, we see in verse 2, "Hasn't he also spoken through us?" When there's conflict of those who oppose us, there's the stated reason for the discontent, and then there's the real reason. And we see that here. Reminds me of the December United News, the lead article by Mr. Kubik, talks about a conflict resolution expert who noted that very thing. There's the real reason for the conflict, and then there's the stated reason, and sometimes the real reason's too embarrassing to talk about. And until that gets addressed, the conflict continues. So what happens next? Well, we know from this particular passage, Miriam is stricken with leprosy. And Moses does what? Moses prays on their behalf. Verse 10, "When the cloud lifted from above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous like snow. Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy and said to Moses, 'Please, my Lord, do not hold against us the sin we have so foolishly committed. Do not let her be like the stillborn infant coming from its mother's womb with its flesh half eaten away.'" The Bible's very graphic. So Moses cried out to the Lord. Again, he has compassion, in this particular case, for those who opposed him. "Oh God, please heal her." The Lord replied, gave his answer, and she was indeed healed. He made intercessions even for those who opposed him. Let's look at Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. Was this the first time that someone had opposed Moses? No. There had been many. And would be many more. And yet he still had it in his heart to pray an intercessory prayer for Miriam, and by extension, Aaron. Matthew 5, verse 44, "But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, sends rain on the just and unjust." Compassion, even for those who opposed him. Lesson 5, or prayer number 5, for the complainers. Again, I have that in my notes. You can put that in yours, for the complainers again. Although you don't have to use parentheses. I did in mine. Numbers 21. Does anybody want to pinch this for me? Numbers 21, we'll start in verse 4. They traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom, but the people grew impatient on the way, and they spoke against God, and this time against Moses as well. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? Thank you. There is no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food, this manna that has all the nutrients and electrolytes that we need, that's so convenient, that doesn't spoil except for when we don't need it. We detest this convenient food from heaven above. It's a good thing we wouldn't be that ungrateful, or would we? So what happens? Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. Do you remember what Indiana Jones said about snakes? Not snakes. Anything but snakes. I hate snakes. Snakes are bad enough, but these are venomous snakes. Have you seen what a constrictor or python can do with its teeth? They have all kinds of razor-sharp teeth in their mouth, and when they bite on, they don't let go. Apparently, they have a very painful bite, but they're not venomous. These aren't just snakes. It's reminiscent of the plague of the frogs in Egypt. I can't imagine walking around palace if you're the pharaoh and stepping on a frog. That would be gross. This is an additional problem. The Lord sent venomous snakes, and they bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take the snakes away from us." So Moses said, "It serves you right, you ungrateful people." Now he prayed for them again. How patient he was. Not only was he humble, but so patient. So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake, put it up on a pole, and when anyone was bitten by a snake and looked upon the bronze snake, he lived. What amazing patience he had, and symbolic in this particular case of Christ being lifted up on the stake. Mentioned also in the book of John. For the complainers again. Matthew chapter 18. You turn with me, please, to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew 18, verse 21. Then Peter came to him and said, "Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him?" Up to seven times. And we've heard messages where this is being described to us and presented as Peter being very generous. Seven times. Was he an only child, I wonder? Seeing three brothers working together, seven times would be used up awful quickly. But this is the question he asked. Up to seven times. Verse 22, Jesus said to him, "I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. Do we forgive our brother?" Limitless. And isn't that what Moses did for the children of Israel? For the complainers again, number five. Number six, for the transition. For the transition. In Numbers 20, let's take a look at Numbers 20, verse 7. The rock. Numbers 20, verse 7. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron, gather an assembly together, speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. And you will bring water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink." What did he do instead? He struck the rock, didn't he? And because of this, there's a penalty to pay. Verse 12, But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honor me, mistake one, as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. After 40 years of successful leadership, Moses makes a mistake, a very bad one, and is told that he will not enter the promised land. What's he going to do? How will Moses take this disappointment, the setback? How frustrating that would be to invest so much time and energy into a people and not be able to lead them into the promised land. It would be very hard to take. But in Deuteronomy 3, we'll start in verse 23. Moses is speaking. Then I pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, verse 24, O Lord God, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do anything like your works and your mighty deeds? Verse 25, here's an appeal. I pray, let me cross over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, those pleasant mountains and Lebanon. Verse 26, the response. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. So the Lord said to me, enough of that. Speak no more to me of this matter. Case closed. He made an appeal. The appeal was denied, and he accepted God's will. Difficult though it may be, disappointing though it must have been, he still accepted God's will. He didn't try to contend with God after this point. He had wisdom to speak no more when God said enough. Matthew 26, verse 36. Let's take a look at Matthew 26, 36. Matthew 26, verse 36. Jesus and his disciples are in the Garden of Gethsemane. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. Verse 37, and he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. And he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. Can we possibly understand the depth of that sorrow, the depth of that distress? Verse 39, he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. We see Jesus Christ setting the same example that Moses did, presenting his case, showing his distress, but willing to accept God's will on the matter, even if it meant hardship or disappointment, pain. Both of them were willing to accept God's will. Once he accepted God's will, let's look at Numbers 27. Numbers 27, verse 15. Numbers 27, verse 15. Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, just give me one more chance. No, he says what here? Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them. Who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep with no shepherd. Verse 18, and the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, the son of Nun, with you, a man in whom is the Spirit. And the transition is made to leadership. So we see Moses accepting God's will, supporting his decision, and then looking beyond himself. He could have had a pity party at this point. Woe is me. Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. I think I'm going to eat some worms. would have been easy to do. But he didn't. In this particular case, he is thinking well beyond himself. He's thinking of the people, the children of Israel, those on whom he had so much compassion before. He's asking God, please lead these people. I've been disqualified. I won't be leading them anymore. Please lead them. Take care of them. Moses' thoughts were on the people. And as Christ himself was enduring the punishment of the flogging, the beatings he withstood, crucifixion himself, was he thinking of himself or was he thinking of all of us? And it's so hard when we suffer to think beyond ourselves, but the example has been set for us in Moses and Christ. So we've seen a number of instances from the book of Numbers in Moses' prayers and how he interacted with the people, how he interacted with God, how he modeled what Christ would model for us. So when we learn from Moses modeling Christ, we learn about Christ and how we should be more Christians. And even though modern Christendom paints Moses as diametrically opposite to Christ, we see, in fact, he is not. He is a model that we can follow. Let's turn to the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews will be our concluding scripture. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 1. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus, who was faithful to him, who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. For this one has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. So we've seen here today, brethren, that Moses' prayers do in fact teach about Jesus.